Well, here it is, July 4th. Fireworks were going off all night and kept me up. They're probably illegally imported from New Hampshire here in Massachusetts. So if I'm grumpy, you'll know why. We will start off with a paper from CGH. As we all know, adding biologics to Crohn's disease management reduces the rate of small bowel resection, and that's great, but how much of a decrease was this? So this paper collected the numbers over the last couple of decades, and it's more impressive drop than I imagined. Before 1993, the rate was 110 per 1,000 hospitalizations, and down to about 100 in 1998, down to 64 in 2014. So from 110 to 64, that's by almost half. So that's a lot of patients not going for surgery. Now, I'm sure some of the reduction is thanks to other better tools such as imaging, other non-biologic, non-surgical management tools, but this drop is still very impressive. I don't think this paper actually shows causation, just a correlation between use of biologics and drop in surgeries, but still very impressive drop. I think TNFs have something to do with it. Moving on to GIE, that has an interesting paper on risk of colorectal cancer in patients with liver disease, and it is a meta-analysis, so as always, take it with a grain of salt. Anyway, prevalence of colon cancer in patients with cirrhosis was twice that of general population, but this study looked at individual causes of liver disease, and highest risk, no surprise there, was in patients with PSC, and it's probably due to connection between PSC and IBD, no doubt. As gastroenterologists, we often get asked, hey doc, what diet should I be on? Should I be on intermittent fasting diet? And as you know, I love a good randomized trial for weight loss. So there is this thing called intermittent fasting that's quite popular. Just Google it. A ton of stuff comes up. My latest pet peeve with diets is saturated versus unsaturated fats, but I'm not going to go into that today. So there's a randomized trial of alternate day fasting effect on weight loss in this month's JAMA Internal Medicine. And bottom line here, daily calorie restriction is just as effective in weight loss as intermittent fasting. So what exactly is alternate day fasting? And I quote here, participants ate more than prescribed on feast days and less than prescribed on fast days, while those on daily calorie restrictions group generally met their described energy goals. Well, critics will say it's still a lot better for you for one reason or another. Maybe fasting glucose is better, maybe cholesterol is better, maybe blood sugar is better, maybe blood pressure is better when you do intermittent fasting. The answer is that there was no difference in any of these parameters. Blood pressure, cholesterol, fasting glucose, all the other things were pretty much the same. A word of caution here, this was done about 25 people in each cohort, which in my opinion is enough people to figure out if there's any difference, but maybe too few for others. Also, this was a 12-month study, and you could see everyone who lost weight slowly gaining it back over time, but there was still enough weight loss at 1 year in both categories. I wonder what the next fad diet is going to be. GIE this month has yet another study, this time from California, regarding urgent colonoscopies for lower GI bleeding. This again is a very salty meta-analysis. They looked at around 10,000 patients in urgent colonoscopy arm and 14,000 in elective colonoscopy arm. Conclusions are awesome. Urgent colonoscopy was associated with increased use of endoscopic therapeutic interventions, and there was no difference in bleeding source localization, adverse event rate, rebleeding rates, transfusion requirements, or mortality. So they conclude, urgent colonoscopy appears to be safe and well tolerated, but there's no clear evidence that it alters important clinical outcomes. My take on this is that if patient is stable and prepped, no need to delay colonoscopy. If they are not resuscitated, then you should probably wait a bit. GIE this month also has a case of a cell phone stuck in someone's stomach presenting with melena. I quote here, afterward, the patient admitted having ingested the cell phone 16 months previously in a fit of anger during family argument. Until 2 months previously, he had been symptom-free. It just goes to show how large objects can sit in the stomach for many, many months without a problem. Just so you know, this was surgically and not endoscopically removed. Has some cool pictures. Another study from GIE, gum chewing has been shown in the past to reduce incidence of post-op ileus, so someone thought of trying it to improve bowel prep quality. So a randomized controlled trial was done to have patients chew sugarless gum. 150 patients in the control arm and 150 patients in the gum chewing arm. In the end, gum chewing didn't improve bowel prep, but patients appeared to be more satisfied with the bowel prep procedure, so it may be useful. Some of the patients infected with hepatitis C also happen to be infected with hep B. It's a real problem, especially for those high-risk patients with ongoing or semi-regular IV drug use. Both the patients and the GI docs have been blessed in the past half a decade with a cure for hepatitis C, one of the only cures we have. So IDSA and ASLD guidelines tell us to screen all hep C patients for co-infections with hep B, but no one tells us what to do next with that information. So in the Hepatology Journal, there is a meta-analysis of patients being treated for hepatitis C who are also co-infected with hepatitis B, and they include data from 28 studies, mainly looking for hep B reactivation here. And is it a problem? And the authors tell us that there was more clinically significant hepatitis due to hep B reactivation in those treated with oral drugs for hep C when compared to old interferon regimens, thankfully, which I've never prescribed. I guess that shows my age. I've noted it happens much earlier and tends to be more severe with direct acting antivirals as well. And the thought here is that hep C superinfection acted to suppress underlying hep B infection in many patients. And once you clear hep C, your hep B comes back. The rate of hep B reactivation was about 12%. And the authors also say that the hep B DNA levels did not correlate with reactivation. So if you don't need to check the hep B DNA levels before treating hep C, you just have to be aware that hep B may come back with vengeance. And another conclusion here is that success of hep C eradication goes down by about 10% in those co-infected with hep B. So watch out for hep B reactivation and treatment failure when you're treating co-infected patients. Every GI doc at some point was asked to place a gastrostomy tube into a patient. Many times this ends up in a prolonged discussion with the family, often phone calls to primary care doctor to try to understand the goals of care, which often rapidly evolve in hospitalized patients. Sometimes it's a no-brainer to put one in, but many times the cases are much more challenging. At the end of the day, we try to quote some studies showing that placing G-tubes probably does not prolong life and probably doesn't provide relief of symptoms. And after you spend all this time, the hospitalist calls you, thanks you for your time, and a day later, you find out the next phone call was made to the IR and they just placed the tube without a discussion. Anyway, the evidence that we present is very, very poor since you can't do randomized trials here for obvious reasons. And there's a paper in CGH this month that looked at patients in Britain with recent G-tube placement and found no improvement in quality of life, but more surprisingly, also no decline in quality of life. And their conclusion basically that maybe the G-tube prevented the rapid decline of quality of life. And that's very intriguing. Maybe in some patients, G-tubes are there to keep things stable and give families a chance to catch up, go to a nursing home, assisted living facility, get rid of the stupid NG tube that's been pestering them. One major caveat in this study is that dementia patients were excluded. And that's probably a good chunk of patients that I was asked to put a G-tube in. So in the end, careful patient selection on a case-by-case basis is still the rule, but it's good to know that somebody's actively studying this and following patients who had G-tube placed. Another case report, this time from Gastro, and this one attracted me because it had a title in Latin, Errare humanum est perseverare autem diabolicum, and it roughly translates, to err is human, but to persevere in error is diabolical. And the story is very interesting here. It's a 79-year-old man, came in with melena, hemodynamically stable, had a negative colonoscopy and upper endoscopy, then had an outpatient VCE, and the recording basically stopped working after about 30 minutes of showing just 25 minutes of esophageal mucosa. So they thought it was a malfunction of the capsule, did a KUB, didn't see a capsule, assumed it passed, and did another capsule. And the same thing happens, 30 minutes of esophagus, and then stops. So what do you think happened? Well, the answer is that they did an x-ray of the neck and the capsules both were nice and snug, stuck right between the two clavicles. What are they doing there? Well, they both got stuck in the Zenkers, which is pretty cool and rare. They basically went in, took one of them out with a Roth net and pushed the other one down into the stomach and got the recording of the small bowel. And his VCE showed some AVMs in the proximal jejunum, which were fixed. Anyway, two capsules stuck in the Zenkers. Never seen that before. Pretty cool. New England Journal published a study titled Association of Changes in Diet Quality with Total and Cause-Specific Mortality. So this is another study showing that better diets lead to less deaths. Nurses' Health Study Database was used to look for changes in the diet in the 1980s and 90s to look what happened to mortality in the 90s through 2000s. Conclusion here is that all-cause mortality decreased in those who had the greatest improvement in their diet quality. So unlike other studies that compare folks on different diets head-to-head, this one compared those who changed their diet compared to those who didn't. So the issues I have with this paper are as follows. Number one, this is part of the nurse's health study, meaning majority of the stuff is self-reported questionnaire kind of data. Second, the definition of healthy diet is based on a very shaky ground. Currently, they are recommending 3 diets, including Mediterranean diet and DASH diet, most of which are what I feel more carbohydrate-based diets than not, including 8 servings of bread and pasta per day. That's a lot of pasta. Third, all-cause mortality is interesting. Maybe people who chose all of a sudden to eat better also started wearing helmets, avoiding all sorts of risks, and also maybe those who could actually stick with better diet had better social support, more fulfilling, less stressful family relationships than those who couldn't do that. There's not enough granularity in the data to look at this type of stuff. I think the conclusions of the paper are aligned with what everyone is thinking, meaning healthy diet, whatever that may be, leads to healthy lifestyle and reduces mortality. I'm not disagreeing with the conclusions here, just question the methodology. But nonetheless, eat healthy and live longer, everybody. The saga of PPI safety continues. Hopefully I won't be mentioning other studies like this for a while. But Andy Chan's group from Mass General published yet another paper, but this time the story is different. While they observed what they call a modest association between duration of PPI use and dementia, when they controlled for the H2 blockers, this association disappeared. Basically, there was no observable convincing association between PPI use and cognitive function. So there you go. Maybe there is no association between Alzheimer's and PPI use. And this article appears in Gastro, if you're wondering where it is. So, once again, give PPIs to those who need them and take them away from those who don't. Just use common sense. And if we ever needed more proof that colonoscopies reduce the risk of death from colorectal cancer, since we don't have any randomized clinical trials yet showing this, there's a very cool paper from Poland which basically showed that if you improve your adenoma detection rate, you get better at reducing the risk of colorectal cancer in your patients. Now, there is a reason ADR is used as probably the most important quality indicator for colonoscopies. And the reason here is that ADR has been shown to have an inverse relationship with interval colorectal cancer and death from colon cancer. So does improving your adenoma detection rate translate into anything meaningful for patients? Turns out for sure, it's true. There is a significant inverse relationship between improving adenoma detection rate and risk of interval colon cancer. They say that if you achieved an ADR in excess of 24.6%, you had a significant drop in interval cancer in patients you're scoping. This was a prospective study of patients who had about 150,000 colonoscopies in Poland by 294 endoscopists. I wonder how many endoscopists there are in Poland total. Now, I was thinking hard about what are some confounders here, and I couldn't come up with any. So keep improving your ADR out there and save some lives, maybe. Can someone tell me what the readmission rate is for diverticular bleeding, and what are the risk factors? There is a paper out there that looked at the National Readmission Database data to look for readmissions for diverticular bleeding within 30 days of the index discharge. So the rate of readmission is about 12%, and risk factors included renal failure, CHF, CAD, AFib, cirrhosis, and abdominal surgery. No big surprise here, but it's good to see the data correlated nicely. And 12% seems kind of high, so that's a surprise to me, but good to know. That's it for now. Thanks for listening. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe to it on iTunes. You can find the links on the website, gipearls.com, and you can follow me on Twitter at @gi_pearls. Suggestions for this podcast are always welcome. If you have articles you want me to look at, send them to me. Several people already told me to change the intro music. I guess there's not that many Rachmaninoff lovers out there. They say it's too somber. Well, I'll look for a replacement. In the meantime, you're gonna have to put up with it. Goodbye.